The Gospels, a commentary. Professor Anthony Frendel and Professor Peter Bassallo discuss excerpts from the Gospels. Readings by Patricia Camilleri. A reading from John, chapter 8, verses 1 to 11. Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. At daybreak, he appeared in the temple again, and as all the people came to him, he sat down and began to teach them. The scribes and Pharisees brought a woman along, who had been caught committing adultery, and making her stand there in full view of everybody, they said to Jesus, "Master, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery, and Moses has ordered us in the law to condemn women like this to death by stoning. What have you to say?" They asked him this as a test, looking for something to use against him. But Jesus bent down and started writing on the ground with his finger. As they persisted with their question, he looked up and said, "If there is one of you who has not sinned, let him be the first to throw a stone at her." Then he bent down and wrote on the ground again. When they heard this, they went away one by one, beginning with the eldest, until Jesus was left alone with the woman, who remained standing there. He looked up and said, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?"
"No, sir," she replied.
"Neither do I condemn you," said Jesus. "Go away and don't sin any more."
Right. So, Peter, we have a beautiful text, a beautiful story to talk about. But before we start our conversation, I think we should point out some textual and historical backgrounds, which could create some problems, or let's say could even paradoxically enough help us. First of all, this passage might not be found by our readers in the Bible where it is actually mentioned from the Gospel of John, because some Bibles put it elsewhere. The reason for this is that in the oldest manuscripts which we have, such as a so-called Papyrus 75, which belongs from the 3rd century AD, which contains this text, the text of John, this passage is not there. And so in the first one or two centuries, this story was floating around in Christian circles, but it couldn't find its canonical place in the text until eventually it was placed by the vast majority where it is, namely in John's Gospel. And there is a reason for that, as we'll point out later on. The other reason for thinking that this passage does not originally come from the pen of John is the style. The style is different. It resembles a lot the style of the Synoptic Gospels, and indeed in some manuscripts it is found in the Gospel of Luke. Well, be that as it may, we may now come to the story. The basic point of the story, I think, and here we can start our conversation, is that Jesus does not deny the law, but he is against those who apply it mechanically. And I think the hermeneutical principle here is that he opts for a key of interpretation, which is interpreting the law of Moses, yes, but in the light of the greater mercy and compassion of God. I don't know what your opinions are on this and on the story as a whole. We might start to
converse
on it.
Yes, I agree with you. This is it's really a lovely story to read. But it's not just a story, I think. An anecdote. It's an anecdote with a specific purpose. It's a test case. The Pharisees are seriously troubled, worried about Jesus, I think. this Jesus fellow, from their point of view, from Galilee, from Nazareth, who's come, who's done remarkable things. And those who were honest with themselves were genuinely trying to find out, how could it be that this Galilean could have such powers? And they were puzzled by it. Where does he get his power from? In fact, they asked him at one stage. Those who were trying to trap Jesus because they saw him as subverting their power, and I think there are some here in this part, found this, the occasion, they've been looking for this occasion, and they found it at last, in the adulterous woman. And, well, they must have been on the lookout for somebody about to commit adultery, so they would be able to say, now, let's see what you're going to do with this.
Exactly.
With his case. And, of course, they drag her along in front of him. Now, what do you say? Expecting the answer, well, Gnosis said that, go ahead and stone her.
Exactly. Carry on.
And, of course, they're putting Jesus in a bit of a dilemma, in a sense. He's obviously not going to go against the law of Moses, because the law of Moses ultimately came from God, and he is all of God. So that's it. But on the other hand, he realizes that, number one, it's a test case, and that that he had been putting indirectly, he had been exposing the self-righteousness and the self-importance and the sticklers to the letter that these Pharisees were, some of these were. And he's going to have to deal with this. And of course there is hostility towards him. And on the other hand, there is this woman, terrified, waiting anxiously for his decision, which he doesn't give immediately. They ask him again and again. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you have the writing on the sand.
That's right, yes. I agree with you completely that this was a test case. They were on the lookout for this. And as you implied, I think the Pharisees here and the scribes were so blind that in trying to follow the law to the letter at all costs, not taking into consideration other values, they in fact break the law themselves. Because in fact, what they say to Jesus is, teacher, this woman was, now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. But they don't say the whole truth. Because the law actually says even the men had to be stoned, not just the women. And there are two important passages. I will just go to one of them. For example, in the book of Leviticus, chapter 20, verse 10, which is the law of Moses, after all, it's explicit. If a man commits adultery with the wife of his neighbor, both the adulterer and the adulteress shall be put to death. So they on the woman, they quote the law partially, as you say, they're sticklers on the law, they quote it partially, they're so blind, they want to pin Jesus down so much that in their evil enthusiasm, if I may say so, they forget to quote the whole law, and they say such women are to be stoned. The point is, even such men are to be stoned, which leads me to believe, obviously the text allows us to think about this, whether this was a genuine case or not, because they would have brought the man otherwise. They either are so blind that they forget to practice the whole law, they just get the woman, or they simply made it up.
Yes. it's difficult now to read.
We can never know this.
You have to be careful.
Yes.
Of the semioticians like Umberto Eco say yeah. about overinterpreting
that's
the
right,
text.
That's right.
It could also be that the man ran away, or they let him get away.
Let him get away. That's more likely.
They let him get away, and let's see what it's going to do to the woman, which would have been, in a way, even more difficult.
Exactly.
To story.
But letting him get away is tantamount to, you know, suppressing a bit the evidence. In a sense, yeah.
it's just ran away.
Yeah.
You don't always catch them both in flagrante.
Exactly.
And the woman is somehow more vulnerable.
That's right. And they knew that Jesus had had a soft, given the culture of his day, he had a soft spot for women beyond what the normal culture prescribed. And so they picked precisely
yes.
on the women also for
yes.
this.
There is this kind of sentimental
exactly.
Attachment. Yeah. You know, it goes with it.
So, for example,
goes with the accusation.
Exactly. He spoke to the Samaritan woman when no rabbi was supposed to speak to a woman on his own, you know, on
yes.
the Sabbath.
Yes.
Now, coming back to your question on, we can never really know this precisely. When the accusation is made, so they said this to test him, so that they might have some charge, as you say. But then, what was Jesus' reaction? It's a non-verbal reaction.
Oh, yeah.
He stoops and writes on the ground. Now, this has caused tons of speculation. Now,
yeah,
let's not speculate too much, as you say, about it. I think there are two possible answers by way of historical background to this. And they could actually be, both could be correct at the same time. Either Jesus is making a non-verbal gesture to say it's not worth the symbolic language, body language, it's not worth discussing with you, because he knew that they only picked on the woman and not on the man, so they were partially quoting the law. It's not worth getting into dialogue or dispute with you. The other possibility exegetically would be, but here, you know, one can never be sure. There is one interesting passage in the book of Jeremiah, where there is a very intriguing phrase, which literally says, those who turn away from me, God is speaking in this passage, those who turn away from me shall be written in the earth. Now, that's a literal translation of the Hebrew, which more or less would mean, those who turn away from me will have their names recorded in the underworld, where the earth is used in a special meaning the underworld, the Sheol of the Old Testament. Now, this was a type of zombie land. There was not yet no belief in the afterlife. Those who went to Sheol couldn't praise Yahweh. Those who went to the underworld couldn't. They were like zombies, literally. And what the text from Jeremiah is saying is, those who cut off themselves from me, from God, therefore, shall have their names recorded in Sheol. They have nothing to do with me. And if Christ was echoing this gesture of writing on the ground, it would be an implication, an allusion to the Jeremiah text, saying, look, you are the ones who are cut off really from God. We can't prove this. But I mean, the background of the Old Testament is always there.
Yeah. Can I just shift a bit
yes.
onto the actual scenario? It presumably takes place, this scene takes place in the temple.
Close by to the temple, yes. The temple area.
The temple area. And I would think that it would be in the temple courtyard.
That's right, because that's where...
Where was people assembled in front of everybody. But the temple was the holy place, and the guardians of the temple, some of the guardians, were the Pharisees themselves. So they're on home ground.
That's right.
He is the foreigner coming.
That's right.
And they're putting him to the test. Now, again, they would be saying, in the question there is the implication, the very subtle implication, do you have the presumption to change the law of Moses, or don't you?
Exactly. That's what they were after.
That's what they were after.
That's right.
If he had the presumption to change the law, by whose power do you have that presumption? It comes up later when they query him whether he's John the Baptist.
That's right.
Whose power did you... Where did you get your terrific power from? Satan? And she says, well, Satan
cannot divide his own house
be divided against itself. And he asks him, he turns that around, and he says, where did John get his power from? And he stopped from there.
That's right.
By writing, he is silencing them.
Yes,
number one, because he's taking out the fury of their accusation, which goes with the accusation, the passion of the accusation.
It's tantamount to ignoring them.
He is diffusing it. Quietly.
That's right.
He's diffusing it. He's writing, and of course this is the great enigma, it is very dramatic, because no word is being uttered. A woman obviously is terrified. There must have been her life, a terrible death of being stoned blow by blow. It takes about half an hour, I imagine, maybe, unless the stone hits the head directly, and apparently they would aim at the head straight away. So that's it itself. The intensity which the people are pressing forward to see what he's going to say, the insistence on an answer, and then the answer comes in writing. And he's writing on the sand of the dust of the courtyard, mm-hmm. presumably. Because the temple would have been nicely paved otherwise. And I think that what he's writing, of course, this is where the reader comes in.
That's right.
This is from a literary point of view. Uh-huh. The reader is, no, there's a gap here.
Where
the reader
here.
Comes to try yeah. to fill.
That's right.
With your perception, with one's powers of observation, with one's intelligence. And I think that he seems to be writing out names of sins. Dishonesty. Fraudulent.
It's very interesting that you...
Names of sin. Impurity. Even impure thoughts, if you like. Which I suppose would have been normal for a very human, and everybody would be subject to that. Taking money from other people. He was just quietly writing a lot. And they are looking at it. And as the stick with which he's writing, or his finger... leaves the ground, they are immediately realizing that they're themselves in a weak position now. Because they are quietly being accused. Yes.
I agree with this possible literary interpretation.
It's literary, I have
yeah.
to say.
No, but it's more than that, actually, because I think it's very interesting that there are, let's say, if we put our textual criticism cap on, there are some manuscripts in this text, in this passage, which add the words that he wrote their sins down.
Oh.
Yeah. Now.
I haven't heard. I'm unaware of it.
Now, the problem is this. Perhaps it's good that our audience also knows this. As you know, we don't own any single autograph of the Bible. In other words, any original manuscript as it came from the printer, so to say, of the author. No original manuscript of Jeremiah. We have copies of copies of copies of copies. Now, some copies are authentic and some others are less authentic. Now, the problem of textual criticism is to establish, as you know, what the original reading would have looked like. Now, usually the point I've just made is not taken as one of the reliable witnesses. But indeed, even a good English translation, like the New Revised Standard Version, points down in a footnote that some manuscripts add this phrase, which is intriguing, which means from very early on, some people thought that that's how it should be read. And I must say, nothing militates against it in the text. I mean, here we're on literary ground. You're the master here. So I think it's...
You've got three levels. The text itself, probably with an interpolation.
Exactly.
Which is incorporated now into the text.
Exactly.
Not a marginal comment.
Exactly.
It is a marginal comment which has now been incorporated. Some manuscripts
have
that. And it seems palpable to thinking that what else could he have written?
Exactly.
His own name, where he's coming from, their names, mm-hmm. Perhaps their names, showing that he knows not only their names but something more.
Unless we would opt for combining a three-tiered interpretation, one not excluding the other.
Yeah.
The symbolic, let's say, if I may use this word, anthropological gesture of Mediterranean people, you know, that's tantamount to listen, I'm going to ignore you. Mm-hmm. He just makes believe he's writing something. One possibility. This obviously does not exclude his having had in mind, he was a scripture scholar after all, a good rabbi, Jesus, apart from being God himself.
Of course.
The echo of Jeremiah. Those who turn away from me will have their names recorded in Sheol. It means he's telling them, you are the ones who are cut off from the God of Israel. Mm. And the third one is what you've said. And I think the three would be possible on three different levels.
Yes,
and that makes it fascinating, I think, to view it that way.
But the first, I'm not quite sure with the first interpretation you're giving, because it would imply a kind of disdain. I'm going a dismissive. A student comes up to you and complaining about the course,
and you
go on writing. Mm-hmm. That would be dismissive. You would be annihilating the student.
Obviously, we can't fool.
I don't think he's annihilating that way, because I think he's already antagonized them enough to know that.
The other two interpretations.
I think the other two interpretations.
The one from
the fact that they silently leave.
Yes.
No, this is dramatic.
Yeah.
You've got the fuss and the shouting and the women sobbing and crying. And Jesus, it's all done in silence. And then it all subsides. And you have him writing, and then as he's writing, one by one, they look at each other in a kind of shame and guilt, and they slink away.
Exactly. In fact, he doesn't say much. Jesus doesn't say much in this passage.
The silence is eloquent here.
It's eloquent, yeah. The only question he really puts is, if anyone has no sin, let him cast the first stone. And then at the end, the woman, obviously, which we'll come to. I would like also to... Yes, Jesus' silence, in fact, we've discussed that. And the other thing which I would like to underscore now is why was this passage in the early church, it was floating around, so to say, why was it in the end put where it is? There is a canonical reason for it, I think. And that would be, there is in chapter 7, which obviously precedes our chapter, in chapter 7 there is one important query, a question, which Jesus, let's say, affirmation, which Jesus makes vis-a-vis the Pharisees. That's chapter 7, verse 24. Do not judge by appearances, but judge with right judgment. And this story fits admirably. The Pharisees, I think, are the ones who are judging the woman superficially, whereas Jesus is going beyond appearances. And now we come, I think, to the most important part of the story, the solution to the tension of the story. I think even from the literary point of view would agree. It's the fact that Jesus endorses compassion and gratuitous mercy as the point of departure for renewal. He doesn't deny the law. He doesn't say that the woman did the right thing, but he, for the moment, brackets that, and he says, has no one condemned you? Neither do I condemn you. And only thereafter does he tell her, go now and sin no more. In other words, she is capable of not sinning anymore because he's changed her before he doesn't condemn. I don't know what you have to say about this.
Obviously, they've all quietly left. This reminds me of this some orchestration symphony where the musicians quietly, one by one, and it ends like that.
And silence comes in.
Silence.
That's right.
The silence is so important. And the silence is broken by a short dialogue. No, sir. No, they haven't. And now she's obviously looking at him intently to see what he's going to say, because he's the ultimate judge. And then he says, well, they haven't, nor will I. But he's made sure that they wouldn't.
Of course.
By writing,
Of course.
So she feels that this is going to be the end, in the sense of the end of her trial, of her tribulation, ordeal. Yes, I you get that feeling as well. But also the important thing is, I mean, that he doesn't say, go in peace, woman.
He doesn't stop there.
He doesn't stop there.
Yeah.
Normally it would be, now go in peace, woman.
Yeah.
No. And do not sin
anymore,
which means do not carry on the relationship.
That's right. But he changed her already. He accepted her before he... The first way was...
I think so.
Augustine has an admirable, in his commentary on this, in his commentary on this text, he says, duo relicti sunt, misera et misericordia. And he plays on the word misera misericordia. So two are left, huh? The miserable one and mercy. But in Latin, as you know, misera et misericordia.
Of course,
there's a play on words.
Play on words.
And I think that's the main point here is that we mustn't judge by appearances, and that Jesus has got the... So I think it's not a story, in my opinion at least, I don't know, it's not a story which aims at moralizing. It's a story which is, I think, Christological.
And tempering, he did say, I did not come to change the law. Okay. Then what did he come to do? To temper it with mercy.
Exactly.
And when he later, well, or earlier, tells Saint Peter now, you know, I give you the power to forgive sins. You can imagine Peter getting out his notebook and saying, no, how many times, Lord? A warden, please, with his new uniform.
Exactly.
And Jesus tells him, seven times, which is infinity.
Infinity.
And there one might imagine a look of slight disappointment on Peter's face. He's really happy with his new role of policing this.
In fact, I think the moral of this story here is that there is a hierarchy of values. So Jesus doesn't deny one value, but as you say, he tempers it with the ultimate, and that is the mercy. And in John, this often comes forth. In John chapter 3, for example, God sent his son to the world not to condemn, not to judge it, but to give eternal life to those who believe in him.
Oh, yeah.
So the a priori mercy of God changes humanity.
And what's interesting is that a test case, which would have really put Jesus in a tight spot, has been turned against those who have tried to do that.
And they failed on all counts, really.
Yes, he wins there
on all counts.
That was Professor Anthony Frindall and Professor Peter Barsalo discussing the Gospel passage chosen for today's commentary.